Okay, I'd like to talk a bit about the theme of the weekend, which is path. And path that we're on, choices that we make, directions that we take. It's an interesting subject, and sometimes we don't really think about it very much. It's as if we are sort of led on a kind of path, and we feel ourselves belonging a little bit to the Buddhist path. We're not sure which path that is exactly, and how much room there is in the path, and so on. So it's something that is nice to contemplate. The Buddhist path in general is quite systematic. It is quite a path laid out for us by others, so that the Buddhist teaching is full, actually, of very structured path instructions. You start from here, you go then to there, you go then to there, you go then to there. For example, there's many lists and many step-by-step instructions in the text, which are still used today. In the Buddhist world, start with listening, then contemplation, then examination, then belief, then trust the teacher, then start practicing, then you reach this jhana, then you reach that jhana, etc., etc., etc. And then all the stages of fruit. You practice like that, you will reach the stream enterer stage, this stage, this stage, this stage. All according to experiences, especially in the medieval Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, very, very detailed texts which describe experiences. If you do it, the Fiha Sefer, you have this experience, that experience, that experience, that experience, etc., etc. And it's a very laid out. One text which is quite nice that describes this in an open way is the Heartwood Sutta, which you might like to look at. It basically says, you go along this journey, when you reach this point, you might think that you've got it, but you haven't, because then there's the next. So at this point, you have this experience, you are changed, a certain transformation happens, for example, transformation of purity of your actions in the world, but no, it's the leaves on the outside of the tree. It's not the heart wood, the center of the tree. You didn't get there yet. So you practice like this, and you think you've got it, but you... So it's continual. Don't stop. Don't be satisfied with where you are, because there's another stage. And more or less endlessly. The text we're going to look at tomorrow is... specializes in this. I remember it's a favorite text that Goenka uses, because it says the Buddha is asked, why is it that some people reach awakening and others don't? And he uses this famous story, you know, the way to Rajgaha. So some people obey the instructions and get to Rajgaha, and other people don't obey the instructions, get lost on the way and find themselves somewhere else. And that's why they don't reach awakening. And Goenka uses this a lot in this story. It's very famous in his retreats. Because Goenka especially is path. The structure around Goenka retreats is very path-oriented. There's 10 days, the third day is like this. Your experiences are generally seen as common experiences. It's 3 days for everybody, and then we all switch to something else. It's like a common experience that's assumed that we're all following path and we all have similar experiences together. And so that text, which we'll look at tomorrow, is very classic, especially for Goenka. You follow the directions of the teacher and you will have this experience, this experience, this experience. But the situation is much, much, much bigger than that, and much more subtle. One of the things that is a big struggle in the teaching is that if you are committed to path, automatically you create an identity. And the identity comes out of the path. When you follow the path, you become a path follower. If you follow a teacher, you become the student of this teacher. You are identified. You have an identity that builds along with path. And it's very much, you know, it's similar in every world where there is a strong practice which is defined. For example, you define yourself as a Jew if, or you are defined by others as a Jew, and you define yourself, you keep mitzvot, you wear a kippah, you do certain things in the Jewish path, and then you take on this label of being a Jewish observant Jew, shomer mitzvot, or same with the monks, the robes, and the path, the things that go with the Buddhist path, create a Buddhist identity, and it's something which is a struggle. And which is an issue. I remember inviting Ajahn Amaro to Israel some time back, and I said, "You have to go everywhere with a mizbeach, kind of a platform with lots of Buddha statues, don't you? You need a kind of altar with many Buddha statues and so on." He said, "Yes, I do." I said, there may be a problem in Israel because there is a strong sense of resistance to sitting, meditating in front of an altar full of idols. Not everybody, but some people may not be able to come because of that. Can you maybe put the table in another room? So it doesn't feel like, even though the people who know they're not practicing towards the idols, the icons there, the statues, they know that you're not meditating to the statues, but nevertheless it feels like that if the statues are at the front and you're the whole hall is meditating in front of them. So can you put them in another room? He said, "No, I can't do that. This is not possible, not my way." I said, maybe you can put them in the back of the room and we face the front and they're behind us. He said, "Oh no, I couldn't do that." I said, "Well, what did the Buddha say then about non-attachment and being free from objects?" And the Buddha himself refused to have any pictures of himself, and for 500 years there wasn't any picture of the Buddha in any icon, in any drawings. He was just depicted as footsteps, just seen as footsteps. By the way, also path, or an umbrella. In the Buddhist pictures, of early Buddhist pictures, there's an umbrella, which is a sign of the Buddha. So he didn't. But the Ajahn Amaro said, "Look, my clothes and my statues is me. I can't. It's like taking off my clothes is that I can't be somebody else. This is part of my path, and this is where I am, and it there's no way I can cut it off." So I said, "Fine, come anyway, and we'll see." But he didn't come, actually. And I don't know whether this was because of the conversation. Anyway, the point is, let's question ourselves right now. Am I on a path? And we had some of the thoughts, and the wisdom came in the groups today, and especially, you know, you talked about your group having this gradation, this sort of gradual from the extreme of no path to the extreme of path, and all the spectrum, tvach, you know, between one and the other. Am I on a path? This is not an easy question in the Vipassana community. It's much easier if you follow directly many of the Buddhist teachers who really define for you a very strict path. And it's dafka also not a question when you are working with the non-dual teachers, Advaita teachers or non-dual Buddhist Tibetan teachers, where there is no path and it's pathless, and I'm going to talk about that. But Vipassana community is rather in between, which is, it's an interesting situation. It's quite difficult to say exactly, yes, we are on a path. You'd be amazed how every single retreat the teachers sit together and sort of work it out from the beginning all over again. It's amazing. We do it every single retreat. I've been teaching retreats 15 years. Still today, the teachers sit together and say, how are we going to do this one? How is it going to develop? And the same with our personal practice. And our personal practice is very individual. There may be some basic instructions, and breath is there, and body is there, watchfulness and mindfulness is there, and some basic tools, but the experience that we go through and the stages of our experience, these are very individual, and we no attempt to collect everybody together into similar experiences. We honor diversity and honor individual journeys, which is quite pathless, and yet there is a path. So we'd call it light path. And this is a tradition, because you find everything in the Buddhist world, this is a tradition within the Buddhist world. There is many, many teachers who say a lot of freedom and some guidance. The path is light. Follow the track, but it gives plenty of room for your individual experience. So I want to talk about that a bit more. I think partly it's the culture we're in. I think that we're in the modern world, that Buddhist practice has arrived in the modern world in a sort of modern and postmodern world. And the culture of the modern world has, in a way, absorbed the practice and made out of it Vipassana, or chosen this kind of Vipassana from the possibilities. There are also, of course, the Tibetan, which is very path, which is very guru-oriented, and the Vipassana community has taken, in a way, the success of the Vipassana community, the mindfulness community, which is huge now in the Western world. I think its success is partly that it hasn't turned it into a religion so quickly. It leaves a lot of room for personal history and differences between people, and your own tendencies and your own gifts and powers working in this rather free way, and that's partly its strength. But it's also its weakness, and some people really don't need more structure. But you see the way there's a lot of coming and going. The people who need more structure would tend to go to the Tibetan teachers, where there's a guru that tells you ABC, or go to, in the Theravada tradition, more Goenka, and so on. I needed structure when I started practice. I went to many, many Goenka retreats, and this for me was, I just didn't want to be an individual to find my own way. I wanted someone to tell me what to do. I just wanted to relax and have someone say, do this, and then do this, and then do this. We should be aware that the Buddha himself didn't teach one path for everybody, and he worked with the individual karma of individual people or individual groups. So in some way or other, this already breaks the path story, because, like, you go to a Goenka course, the teacher has no idea who's sitting in front of them. There's 100 people in the room, they all get the same instruction. The Buddha, it wasn't like that. He allowed the differences of personality, and there are. There's some people that appeal more wisdom. There's some people more devotional, that appeal to the heart. There's some people that need service, that need to work, need to act in life, that need to serve. There's some people that are really touched by morality and ethics. There's some people that are more intellectual, and they start with the intellectual path, and that's their power. So in a way, the path needs to work with your power, namely your karma, what is strong in you, working with the strengths that you have. And the Buddha did that. He gave different instructions to different people. But that needs already wisdom, which is the right one for me. So here we have a kind of circle. We need wisdom to show us the path, and we need path to show us the wisdom. The two go around each other. So for us to individually develop our path, we already need the wisdom. And the path then shows us our wisdom, helps us to go further. So we are all the time dancing between our insight and how we develop the path for us, and which is the right path for us. Generally, the path always includes getting lost. We're always going to get lost in the path. And especially in the path that's more open and free. And so we've got a kind of journey in which we follow instructions, and then we let them go and we get lost. And we're not sure what to do next, or we're not sure what to choose, or we're not sure what this teacher says or what another teacher says. Or we read many, many teachers and we don't know which one to choose. And then we find that this inspires, so we go on a path, and then we have a moment, we get lost again. This is natural. This is not a problem. It's a quality of a more open path. So there is a cost in an open path, which is that we can have periods of confusion or periods of uncertainty when we don't know which person to follow, which path, or what to do next. But the cost of having a really tight path is another cost. We pay a price there too, which is that we lose capacity. We don't touch parts of us that maybe need to be need to be employed. The teacher will say, do this, 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 but we don't bring all of us into this journey. So, there's a lot of questions in all of this. Firstly, if we don't have a clear path, then we don't also have a clear identity. And are we happy with that? Are we a Buddhist? It's very difficult to answer. Everyone here will give a different answer to that, I would have thought. It's not an easy a question, because the identity isn't so clear, because it's a more open field of practice. What's our how do we develop commitment if the path is not so clear? What do we commit to? So again and again and again we give teachings on commitment to wisdom, commitment to the Buddhist principles, or the Buddhist freedom, to awakening. But in the daily life and in the moment by moment, what is it we commit to in our commitment? So these are questions. How much self is there in the path? Is it my path? Is it the Buddha's path? Am I just following the Buddha, or am I following me? Or Stephen or Christopher, or who am I following? Which teacher, which moment, what Where is the self in all of this? So these are questions which are very, very legitimate, and we can take them as confusions, or we can take them as wisdom. The wisdom is always about the meeting point between the known and the unknown. If it's all known, it's not wisdom. It's just knowledge. If it's all unknown, it's all mystery and confusion. So the wisdom is always about touching the unknown. So these questions are not problems, but they're the meeting point between the known and the unknown. And they touch all of our life, of course. The self, who am I, where am I going, which is some of the issues we're going to discuss together. Do we know where we are going? Do we have any idea where we're going? It's all right to say yes, it's all right to say no. You can say both, it's fine, we're with both. We can say, I don't know where I'm going. I say, yes, I do know where I'm going. But they're the same, they're part of the growth of wisdom in us. So, we do need a lot of tolerance to the unknown, a lot of allowing of the unknown, because the transformation that happens to us is transformation from the unknown. It's not the known that transforms us, it's the unknown. So we need a lot of tolerance and give it a lot of room and allow ourselves to get lost. Once someone told me one time, what Krishnamurti talked about, the pathless path, right? The path without a path, pathless path. Okay? How do you travel the pathless path? You get lost. Just get lost. And we have to have tolerance to this and allow it. There's no real, in a way, wrong path. We can have a lot of trust. It's not so easy to get really stuck or really lost, because we have a lot of support from the tradition, from teachers, from the wisdom that we receive from the Buddha and all the teachers. So it's actually, we can have trust, because although sometimes we can feel we don't have a path, we're not sure where we're going, underneath we're not in trouble. It's just that this is a rather open field, and so we're travelling in an open field rather than travelling on a railway line. Okay, and it's quite hard to get really stuck. I meet a lot of people. We have a lot of one-to-ones and so on over the years. I don't meet people that are really lost and stuck on the issue of path. It can be like this, but we can trust that as long as we keep in touch with the teachings and with the questions in some way, we're okay, we'll be all right. And that's the sutta, that's the image of the logs that I was talking about today. That somehow or other the logs will get there. Nevertheless, I think we have to remember that all paths are artificial. They are inventions. Somebody invented a journey of the self. The Buddha or a teacher that tells you do this or do that. It is an invention. It's a construction. And as a construction, it's basically part of samsara. It's a sankara. It's a construction. Therefore, every path in the end has to be abandoned. And the Buddha said it very clearly. When you take the path and take the instructions, cross the river, regard them as a raft, rapsoda. But when you reach the other side, you don't need to take this raft on your shoulder and keep walking across the field thinking, well, I might need it over there. You reach the other side, let it go. And that's our protection also. And that's something natural, that it's a natural process. We let go of tools, methods, inventions, strategies that the self uses to transcend itself. Right? To go beyond it. The self is using these to go beyond itself. It uses all the tools it can find to go beyond itself. But then it can let these tools go. It can just let them go. And there's some Buddhist paths which are very, very strong on letting path go, like Zen. A lot of Zen practice is very pathless. But, and here's something interesting, there's a lot of teachers of pathless, of no path. Dzogchen tradition in the Tibetan, Zen, and so on. But you will never find a Dzogchen teacher that says, you can start with pathlessness now, and you don't need to do anything ever. I mean, like, nothing to do. There will always be somewhere behind a journey which is quite path to get to the place where there is no path. Somewhere or other, there is, like Keith, when he's teaching here, there's a lot of visualizations there and so on, but there's nothing to do. But yet there's visualizations and there's practices and so on, but in Dzogchen there's nothing to do. Krishnamurti said, the pathless teacher, Advaita teacher, he said, no, you don't need a path, but you need intensity. That's what he called it. In other words, you need to build a power of intensity. Otherwise, it won't work. Pathlessness. No path. You have to have. Nisargadattan Maharaj talks about, you have to be serious. You can't just say, there's no path, it's going to happen by itself, nothing to do, like, come down to the top of the mountain, just parachute down to the top of the mountain, don't need to climb the mountain, just drop down onto the top, easy. Nobody says it's easy. On the contrary, sometimes the pathlessness, the real pathless teachers, like Zen, it feels impossible to get there. It's like there's nowhere to hang on to. They're just offering a kind of infinity. And how do you jump to infinity? So it's sometimes you go back, I need a path. I need to know what's next. So what I'm trying to say, I think, is between the two there is a dialogue. And we are pushed and we are pulled. We are pulled in a way by the pathless movement in us that just unfolds and things open and we are surprised and we get surprised. Things open in us that we don't know and we do feel pulled by maybe a karma, a different karma that's pulling us. Like I said, awakening, pulling us, we hear about it, we move to it, something is happening to us, and we're pushing also. But the two go together, and we are in the path and the pathless all the time. The image I used is, I think I sent you an article I wrote about this, of going up the mountain, and then, no one goes up the mountain like this and looking at every step. We also look around at the trees and we look around and then we stop and there's the pathless moment where we just appreciate the flowers or we look at our body or we feel our feet as we're walking. There's no path there. It's just existence. And then we're back on path again. Oh yeah, here's the path. And then we lose it again. And, oh, the flowers, the trees, the sky. Oh, where am I? Oh, here I am. So it kind of, the two always dialogue with each other, the path and the pathless. And it's interesting to be aware of this, to watch it inside us, and to navigate. Say, okay, I'm too far here, this is not good for me, I'm too lost in this. I need to get a little bit more solid practice, or the path has to be clearer. Or, no, I'm having a period now with just letting go, a period in my life. And as you move along the path, that dialogue changes. And basically, everyone's experience is as you carry on the spiritual journey, you get less and less interested in path. That the path becomes less and less important as you develop. And the Buddha talked about this as well. For example, how stream enterers don't need to trust rituals anymore, or don't need to believe in rituals, for example. Yeah, I think that's basically what I want to say, that it's a useful thing to contemplate and have a dialogue inside us, and to observe the way this dialogue changes as we move, as we progress, as we change and transform. The need for path changes, the need or the interest in pathlessness changes. We have less getting lost without path. We have more ability to trust the journey, the process, which is what came up today. It depends on where we are, whether we can trust the process or not, or how much we trust the process. It's not something fixed, it's something dynamic. The whole thing is very, very dynamic. And this year we'll be in a different place in relation to path and pathless in relation to known and unknown than last year. And it will just be a constant movement in which path and pathless are always talking to us. So, that's what I want to say. Thank you. So just take a couple of moments of silence and to contemplate that.